Welcome to DAD, Dads Aren't Deadbeats, a community of care and compassion in observance of the Golden Rule. Come and join us and contribute to riveting conversations about fathers, their children, rights and agency.
It's Monday.
Here in the UK, it's National Pie Week.
And you are very welcome to the DAD podcast. This episode is sponsored by Pacifism, Logic and Reason. Because if we can't talk about our problems, how are we anything more than Neanderthals?
Indeed it is.
So the Pie Factory, that's in Cradley, and if any of you guys don't know, we are Birmingham-based boys ourselves.
We are indeed, and the Pie Factory is a wonderful little restaurant that serves, well, pies, surprisingly.
Really?
They do. Pies and other
and things. Don't forget the chips.
A very nice place to frequent if you've never been before. We definitely would recommend it. So before we begin, let's do the thing we usually do. Two guys in a shed, not legal experts, and so on. The information we bring you is on an as-is basis, and whilst a great deal of time and research goes into producing these shows, there may be occasional errors. Where these appear, we will do our best to correct them. The information you are hearing in the pod is brought to you in good conscience, and we plan on being as accurate as we possibly can. So, how's your week been, buddy? What have you been up to?
It's not been too bad. Well, I've just finished work for the week. I've got the children tomorrow, so we're going to do a bit of soft play and have some fun.
Nice.
How's your week been?
It's not been too bad at all. Same thing. Busy, busy, working. I've got a presentation to give next week I'm a little bit nervous about.
And I know everybody looks forward to the weekend, but not you, do you?
I do. I get to spend a bit of time with Sandy, and that's always nice. But I always have at least a day working.
Yes.
But that's that's more for my own sanity than anything else, just stay on top of things.
Fair enough.
So what are we talking about today, buddy, and why should anyone in listener land care?
So today we're building on the conversation we had last week about non-molestation orders. We will expand our understanding of the important aspect of civil law and discuss how non-occupation orders are closely associated with the topic of last week's discussion.
So let's do it. Would you like to begin?
Sure. As discussed last week, court intervention is sometimes required where allegations of domestic abuse are raised between a complainant, that is the person who's claiming the abuse, and a respondent, that is the person who's accused of the abuse.
Two of the most frequently used remedies in domestic abuse cases are non-molestation orders and occupation orders.
And both occupational orders and non-molestation orders are types of court injunctions. Both have enforcement jurisdiction of the civil courts. This basically means civil courts are responsible for the reviewing of the applications, the granting of the orders, and monitoring everything else to go with it.
Absolutely. So breaching a non-molestation order also carries discrete criminal offences of its own, and these can be tried in a criminal court. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that's true for occupation orders too.
That is true, yeah.
Yeah. So in this podcast, we will explore these two injunctions and the implications of breaching them. We spoke at length about non-molestation orders last week, so we're only going to touch on it here again this week. And we'll also look at statistics to demonstrate the scale of these orders.
So, as Matt just said, we spoke about the non-molestation orders last week, but we will mention them again. Now, I know if you guys haven't listened to the podcast before, please do listen because there's some very useful information on there. And this is important in the demonstrating the relationships between both of these types of orders.
The definition of non-molestation orders is outlined within Section 42 of the Family Law Act 1996.
This section outlines two provisions, and either or both of the following provisions are made through non-molestation orders. Number one, provision prohibiting a person, so the respondent, from molesting another person who is associated with the respondent. And number two, provision prohibiting the respondent from molesting a relevant child.
So the Family Law Act does not define the term molesting, which is unusual because such terms are usually clearly defined in law. However, the word molest has been considered to mean the same as pester. This was established in case law in the case of Vaughan versus Vaughan in 1973. In this case, the court considered the definition of molestation from the Oxford Dictionary, which states that molestation is to cause trouble, to vex, to annoy, or to put to inconvenience.
In another piece of case law, molestation was considered to not just relate to violent behaviour. This was settled in the case of Davis versus Johnson in 1979. They considered molestation to be any conduct which can properly be regarded as constituting a degree of harassment as to call for the intervention of the court.
There is a legal test set out in Section 42 of the Family Law Act. This test encourages the court to have regard to all of the circumstances of the case.
And this test looks a little something like this. There must be evidence of molestation. The applicant must need protection, and the judge must be satisfied on the balance of probabilities that judicial intervention is required to control behaviour which is subject to the complaint.
So this is an interesting little legal test, Lee. Because whenever you're balancing anything on probabilities, it's almost a bit like a gamble. Right.
Well, we've had a lot of conversations on probability and possibilities, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Do you want to explain to listener land the difference?
I can certainly try. Almost anything in the world could be considered to be possible. There are then just degrees of probability. So it could be possible that aliens are living amongst us, but it's highly improbable that that's the case. It could be possible that in a universe of hundreds of billions of stars, there could be alien life somewhere out there. And based on several equations, it's probable also. Possibilities and probabilities aren't the same thing. And whilst anything in the world is possible, not everything is probable. But again, it's this question of evidence.
Yeah.
And where there's an absence of evidence, there's no good reason to believe something is probable.
Especially when you do have evidence, yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So what we at DAD think is misunderstood in the protection orders is the criminal consequences of breaching the order, right, Lee?
Indeed. Under Section 42A1 of the order, a breach of a non-mole is a criminal offence specifically, and to use legalese, it is an offence where a person, without reasonable excuse, does anything prohibited under this order. This can include breaching zonal restrictions or making contact with the complaining party if the order prohibits this.
That's right, but let's remember that if he, she, they is unaware of the existence of an order, that person is unlikely to be subject to criminal charges. So, last week we spoke about how an order is not a standing order until the court bailiff or the process server,
yes,
as they're now known, hands you that paperwork. So if up until that point you haven't received the paperwork, you cannot be arrested, or at the very least, let's not say cannot, it's a bit whilst improbable, not impossible, you shouldn't be arrested until you're in possession of that order.
That's right, and this could be a particular problem when the order is made ex parte or without notice. Persons knowingly breaching this order can be subject to police arrest, with prosecution being dealt with by the Crown Prosecution Service. Such cases can be tried in either magistrates or even worse, Crown Courts.
Now, as we said last week, men, women and non-binary others who breach non-moles or who are domestically violent should be buried under the prison. We're proud to stand tall with other organisations in fervently opposing all forms of violence. Pacifism, reasoning and logic are much better objectives in resolving our problems.
Do you know something? I'm going to say something now. I think when I was about 12 or 13 and you actually taught me the word pacifism that long ago, and I remember when I think of that word, I think of you. I do. It's crazy.
Pacifism is the way forward.
Well, you've always been a pacifist, haven't you, dude?
More or less.
Yeah. Drawing national data sets to demonstrate the scale of this issue is very difficult. We have managed to extract some information from London. Between 2021 and 2022, in the Greater London area, 584 individuals were either summoned and or charged with breaching non-molestation orders.
So that's quite a significant number of people in the Greater London area. That, I think, to refine these statistics further, this was statistics for a particular... it wasn't the whole year, it was between the months of...
Yeah.
So it isn't actually a 12-month period. It's a series of, I believe, 6 months. And this was FOIA'd information from 21-22 that's available on the internet. What's interesting here is that, based on the conversations we were having last week, if 25% are spurious, then it does call into question how sound the arrests of these 584 individuals was.
But again, having an active non-molestation and occupational order, you break them orders, you will get arrested.
Absolutely. And to be clear, folks, just so that we're all on the same page here, breaking the order, or breaching the order as it's known, it doesn't necessarily mean you're being violent. A breach of the order is if there's a zonal restriction that places you outside of your matrimonial home, to enter the home is a breach of that order, and you can be arrested, and there's a high possibility you will be. We'll be sharing a story later about that very thing.
So we know non-moles protect potential victims of crime, but there's another order closely associated with this one relating to who can occupy the matrimonial home or the shared home. An occupational order offers protection. There are a number of categories of occupational orders, and these are defined in the Family Law Act.
So occupation orders can be either declaratory and regulatory. So let's chat about the difference between the two.
A declaratory order is an order which declares, extends, or grants the right to occupy.
Whereas a regulatory order is an order that controls or restricts existing rights to occupy all or part of the family home. So regulatory orders have several capacities, including allowing the applicant to remain in the house, requiring the respondent to allow the applicant to enter and remain in the family home, regulate occupation to the family home, require the respondent to leave or occupy part of the family home, prohibit, suspend, or restrict the respondent's right to occupancy, and excuse the respondent from a defined area in which the family home is included.
It's very much the family home, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So an occupational order, guys, is basically about where you're living, mm-hmm. isn't it?
And who can live there.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
It's about who is seen as being legally entitled to be in that space.
Yeah, and whilst these orders are critical in safeguarding individuals from abusive situations, it is essential to acknowledge the potential drawbacks and unintended consequences of their issuance and enforcement. Should we chat about some of these, Matt?
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
So we at DAD are ardent supporters of Human Rights Act 1998. One of the most egregious aspects of these orders is the restrictions they impose on the rights of individuals to occupy their own homes. Now, we're all in agreement that where somebody has to be domestically violent, removing them from the family home is absolutely the right thing to do. But for those who haven't, those who have had false accusations levelled against them is problematic. Tell listener Len why.
Okay, well, such orders result in a person or persons becoming displaced from their home, which in law would be referred to as their primary residence. This is often to the detriment of considerations around their rights as homeowners or as tenants. This is particularly challenging in cases where both parties have equal rights to reside in the residence, leading to disputes over occupancy and causing further tensions in the family unit.
So what's interesting here is that the Human Rights Act has several articles that might be relevant in the case for an arrest for breaching occupational orders. Now, this is problematic because if the foundation of a non-molestation and occupational orders are spurious to begin with, this may open the door for civil litigation.
Absolutely. And perhaps we can talk about a specific case of that happened. I'll say recently. If we say recently on the podcast, we're talking academic currency, which is like 5 years.
Yeah.
So it's happened in the last 5 years. We'll call this person Sarah for the sake of argument. That seems to be our go-to name when we're trying to
Sarah.
Hide the name of people, doesn't it? So we'll call this person Sarah. So Sarah and her husband were living in the matrimonial home. She had two children with her husband, and she was basically issued a non-molestation order and an occupation order. Now, they often do come in tandem. You get them together. Where there's one, there's the other. And in fact,
because it's the same form, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the it's an extension of the non-molestation order, essentially, to request the occupation order. So she had a non-molestation order taken out against her and an occupation order. And the occupation order prevented her from going into the house, and she wasn't to harass her husband. So interestingly, the non-molestation order included restrictions associated to it, arrestable restrictions. So if she was seen to be harassing, causing distress, alarm to her husband.
So you just said that, and now I'm thinking I know that molestation or non-molestation orders can contain a zonal restriction.
Mm-hmm.
So how were they still in the same house? Was there a zonal restriction in this matter?
Yeah, so the issue was that she wasn't necessarily in the same house, and there wasn't a zonal restriction within the non-molestation aspect of the order, but within the occupation order there was.
Right.
So she wasn't allowed to be in the house on the occupation order, but the non-molestation order allowed her to be to see her children under certain fixed conditions, as these things are, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Not at the house. So what happens is she goes out for a night out with the girls, and they happen to drive past the family home. She's stopping with a friend, and as is often the case, lots of your friends when you're in a marriage are, generally speaking, centred around where you live.
Yeah.
So she's stopping with a friend, and they drive past in a cab at the end of a night out, and she notices at 9:30 on the night the front door to the house is open.
Okay.
So she asks the cab to stop, steps out of the cab, hears noise, gunfire and shouting and screaming, and she's worried for the well-being of her children. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was ever concerned that my wife or children were in a house with the front door open and I was hearing screaming, I'd be in.
Well, it's not just that. If I was driving past my house,
yeah,
and I saw the door open,
yeah,
and it was nighttime, I would, and there's nobody there, and you would go up.
Absolutely. So she does.
Yeah.
She goes up to the house. She walks in and she realizes the noise, the shouting, is her children sat playing video games.
Yeah.
So once she's satisfied that the children are safe, she points out, you know, you've got to get to bed. It's a school night. They're primary school children. It's a school night. You need to go to bed in a bit. She looks up, and the husband's in the corner of the room with his phone out, video recording her. And now what happened then was he called the police, and now he's got video footage of her entering the house. But when the police arrive, they arrest her for a breach of the non-molestation order. Well, she wasn't harassing him. She wasn't molesting him in any way. The orders were that she couldn't go into the house. There was a zonal restriction under the occupation order aspect of the orders, and not under the non-molestation order. So the police arrest her incorrectly, put her in a prison cell overnight. She has to go to court, magistrate's court, the next day, in the same clothes she was arrested in. Has to turn up at the magistrate's court, have the hearing heard. She's got a duty solicitor with her. The duty solicitor has to point out that she was arrested under a breach of a non-molestation order. She didn't breach it. By his own admission and the video evidence, she hasn't breached a non-molestation order. She entered the house because she was worried for the well-being of her children. She's breached an occupation order. She had to go for two further hearings, and thankfully now has secured a decent lawyer and has sued the police for wrongful arrest because they arrested her under the wrong premise. The reason for arresting him was the non-molestation.
Well, and what time was this on the night?
9:30.
So, let me put another spin on things. For example, why was the front door open?
Yeah,
and why was he there with his phone waiting to record? And how did he know she was going to come past the house?
Clearest case of entrapment I think I've ever seen.
And that's how occupational orders can work for you.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that.
Yeah, definitely.
So occupational orders can often impose a significant financial burden on the parties involved. Occupational orders can often impose a significant financial burden on the parties involved. For the respondent, the individual subject to the order, being required to leave the family home may lead to the need to find alternative accommodation at very short notice and potentially at a much higher cost. Have you seen the going rate for rent lately, Matt?
I absolutely haven't. To be honest, I'm completely flabbergasted at how much it costs.
I've always saw renting. It's just dead money, isn't it, guys? You know, it's just money down the drain.
I mean, it can be, but I mean, at the end of the day, there's a large proportion of the British population do rent, and a large proportion of those do so because they have to. And what's criminal is that we had a very good, world admired social housing system in the UK until relatively recently. But then now what we're finding is that a lot of councils did the right to buy scheme and haven't replaced properties with the properties they've sold. Yeah. So like Birmingham, for example, Birmingham had 161,000 social housing units 10 years ago. They've now got something like 90. So it's a huge drop off. It's a significant concern.
Indeed, it's a massive concern. I mean, for some people, especially for myself, I was fortunate enough. I had an inheritance when I was younger. Couldn't touch it till I was 21. It was an absolute nightmare to get it out because it was in solicitors' hands and stocks and shares. But that gave me the start to, you know, the start in life and the start to obviously get a mortgage. And I use that as a deposit for a house.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really good use of money, putting it into property, because yeah. property only ever gains value, so it's yeah. kind of a, it was a good thing to do. Yeah, indeed. So it's ridiculous at the moment, and social housing as a system is in a state close to collapse, as we've said, and particularly in this region. Samwell and Birmingham are having all sorts of problems, really probably because the way local authorities are funded, the funding model changed several years ago, and a lot of the money that was made on selling off houses through sort of the rent to buy schemes hasn't been put back into repurchasing properties or rebuilding. So that's the reason that we're seeing the situation we are in this region. So I think the biggest concern with occupation orders is the additional cost it brings to both parties. This is why the DAD platform encourages advocacy between parties with a view to arriving at mutually agreeable decisions that act in the best interests of the child or children. I'm not convinced the family law system has enough invested in this aspect of the law.
Now, at Dad, we have a little fun motto we like to play with, and you will hear this at the start and at the end of each and every podcast. For riveting conversations about fathers, their children, rights and agency. The subject of the children is one we have not spoken about much up until this point, and there's very good reasons for that. We will, of course, as time goes on, explore our children and their rights in much more detail in the future. We will also explain in a future episode why we have held back on this up until this point. So, Matt, would you like to talk about the impact on the children?
Sure, why not? So, in a future episode, we're going to discuss the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, 1989, and we'll tie this in with the discussion around the Human Rights Act, 1998. So, issuance of an occupation order can have a profound effect on children. Displacement from the family home can be very disruptive for all children involved, and it can disturb their routine, lead to damages in their social connections, and can damage their sense of stability. The upheaval caused by occupation orders can also exacerbate those feelings of anxiety, trauma, insecurity, and emotional and psychological well-being. So, moreover, the adversarial nature of the legal proceedings surrounding occupation orders can expose children to additional stress, further compromising their welfare.
The omission of one parent from a home can also add to this stress, but obviously, if an individual has been domestically violent towards a partner or the children, their welfare can be improved.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I completely agree with that. But, yeah, how do you feel about this idea of kind of, I'm conflicted on whether children should be completely shielded from these processes or whether they should be told about them. I think
it goes on the age and the maturity of the children.
Yeah.
Personally, I mean, if you've got young children, they definitely don't need to know what's going on with potentially mum and dad mm-hmm. or what's going on in that household, because you will see changes in the children.
Yeah, I agree. And being an early years practitioner myself, maturation plays a significant role here. I've always very much had the attitude as a parent that when my children were old enough to ask me a question, they're old enough to have an answer. Yeah. But I do think that answer sometimes has to be modulated to their age.
100%. You yeah. don't obviously go full force and say, well, this has happened and this has happened, yeah, because yeah. you will damage the child.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it adds to those stresses and traumas and all of that we've just mentioned that can so negatively affect the child.
And I think when an occupational order has been granted, and obviously, you know, more than less, it's either going to be the mum or the dad that is going to leave the home. Mm-hmm. So that straight away has affected the children. They don't need any more burden on them.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And that's the big point here, I think. The adversarial nature of the proceedings does mean that the children, to some extent, are going to feel something of this.
Yeah, but you do. I think you do your best to shield the children.
Yeah, absolutely. It's our moral responsibility.
But if your children are, you know, 20 plus, it's fine.
Yeah,
you know, because they understand.
And if they can't handle it at that age, tough.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Moments ago, we spoke about the adversarial nature of these proceedings. What we haven't discussed up until this point is the nature of non-molestation orders and occupational orders being intrinsically connected.
That's right. So non-molestation orders are often accompanied by occupation orders because they're part of the same form, essentially. It must be said, though, that fewer occupation orders appear to be granted than non-molestation orders. So according to the Ministry of Justice, this was more than 1,500 last year. That is significantly less than the 30 some odd thousand non-molestation orders that were granted. So what are some of the reasons for this, Lee?
It may have something to do with the legal test for this. Occupational orders result in a material deprivation of human rights, and I'm convinced the court has to be as close as to 100% sure of the risk to the well-being before one of these can be granted.
Yeah, occupation orders have a very strict legal test. This is essentially because any deprivation of human rights requires consideration. So the test works as follows. The first is something known as a balance of harm test, and it outlines the court's duties to balance the harm caused to the applicant, the respondent, and any children involved. There are exceptions to this test. For example, if any party is likely to be harmed by the order,
if the balance of harm test fails, the case of Chalmers versus John, 1999, set a precedent allowing the court to grant an occupational order via the court criteria test and other factors outlined in the Family Law Act, section 33.
So, Lee, do we know what that involves?
We sure do. Under this section, the court has the discretionary power to grant an injunction and should have regard to all circumstances, including but not limited to the housing needs and resources of each of the parties and any relevant children, the likely effect of any order or of any decision by the court not to exercise its powers on the health, the safety and the well-being of the parties and any relevant children, the financial resources of each of the parties, and the conduct of the parties in relation to each other.
So it's an interesting one, that last one, that the conduct of the parties in relation to each other, is basically, I think, there to allow a court to evaluate the degree of harm that might be caused by having people that are domestically abusive in the same space, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on that. As you just said, it evaluates whether the harm caused to the applicant or the child is a the result of the granting of the order. Now, obviously, we're looking at the balance of harm. Now, there are many forms of harm or
Indeed.
Domestic abuse. You know, it's not just, I mean, straight away you think of domestic abuse, you think of someone punching someone in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you? But, you know, there's verbal harm, there is emotional harm, financial harm, and also someone's mental health mm-hmm. at stake. So it's not just all about, you know, jumping in thinking it's a bruise or it's been a fight or something like that. There's a lot of mentally challenging obstacles to come with this.
Absolutely.
Especially for the individual who's faced with the occupational order.
I mean, I've got a story I can tell about that.
Full of knowledge you are, aren't you?
It's not really that, though, you know. It's just that I've been around nearly 50 years. It's just, you see a lot as you get older, and that's all it is. You just sort of end up with 50 years worth of shit that you've seen, and then you get to recite it. So I had a friend, a school friend, who we'll call Alex for the purpose of this. Alex was a guy, I didn't really know him well at school. We'd see one another in the corridor and say hello, we're in the same form group, didn't really have much to do with him. And then when I met your aunt, we went to live in a flat in Birmingham city centre, and Alex was homeless at this point. So yeah, we'd see Alex every Friday night, and we'd go up, and Friday night was treat night, so we'd have a Kentucky Fried Chicken or some form of takeaway, treat the kiddies and sort of, and you as well when you were around at ours of a weekend too,
yeah,
right?
I remember it, yeah.
Remember those? So you might even have met him, that being the case. So when we go up to the Kentucky, Alex would be there, and he was homeless. And essentially he was homeless because he'd married relatively young, and his wife had put him out of the house.
Okay. With an occupational order.
Yes. Yeah. And Alex didn't have the financial means to buy himself another property, and so he was sofa surfing for a while. Then he ended up in a shelter, and then
like
ended
a hostel
up out,
and
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
like.
Yeah, and then ended up out on the streets. And whilst he was out on the streets, he would he ended up becoming a heroin addict. And his argument to me was, it is literally the only way I can stay warm out here. And so he'd
getting off your face.
Yeah, essentially. So taking heroin, he'd say, it makes me feel warm. It gives me that a sense of comfort. But this guy was the nicest guy imaginable. So the reason he had the occupation order taken out against him was because he was accused of being verbally and physically aggressive to his wife.
Okay.
And so I'll get to the end of the story real quick now. Now, obviously, I can't speak about what Alex was like in the confines of his own home or in the confines of his marriage. That none of that's important to me. But what I can do is comment on how he was around everybody I saw him speaking to and around my family. Every time he'd see our youngest daughter, she'd run up to him with a Kentucky sandwich of a Friday.
A Kentucky sandwich?
Dinner. Yeah, you know, like,
oh, like a burger.
A burger,
yeah.
And she was ever so proud to hand him this. And every time he saw her, he'd put his hand in his pocket and give her money. Every single time. He was just a really nice guy. He ended up committing suicide sometime later because it all became too much for him, and the social stigma of being accused of these things. Mm. And by the way, to the day he died, he ardently denied having done anything. He was never taken to court for it. He was never found guilty. He was never arrested.
But he basically lost everything for nothing.
He lost everything in his life for it, yeah.
And where do you go from there if you're out on the streets? And I don't know if Listenland's picked up on this, but in my opinion, I just want to run this by you, Matt.
Yeah.
You, obviously, you've stated he didn't have the money, he was living on the streets. Mm-hmm. How was he affording heroin?
So he was affording heroin in the same way most homeless addicts do, by begging for money and using that money for drugs. I kind of get a bit defensive of homeless people because of Alex.
Yeah, but so, we're not saying that everybody homeless are drug addicts.
No, not at all.
We're not
at
saying
all.
That at all, because some are decent.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a story as well in a second. I mean, it's not as good as your story, obviously, but yeah, you carry on with yours, Matt.
Yeah, so I get defensive over Alex and everybody else that's on the street for several reasons. So I was actually pulled up by the police in Nottingham. That's a whole different podcast, and we will come to it eventually.
You like the police, you do, don't you?
No. And I was pulled up because I was handing somebody who was homeless some change and a sandwich, and they were telling me you shouldn't do that. It's encouraging vagrancy and trying to make up some law for the reason I couldn't feed somebody that was homeless. And one of the officers says to me, all he's going to do is use that to shoot up tonight. And
what?
So I said, so
what, you know, a sandwich?
We know the money I gave him.
Oh,
as well.
Money,
so, yeah, put some money in a sandwich there. And so I looked at the officer and I says, when you go home tonight, it's a Friday night, when you go home tonight, you're going to pour yourself a glass of wine. Do you smoke cigarettes? Do you drink tea? Do you drink coffee? All of those things are addictive substances too.
Mm.
So why is it different that you use an addictive substance and he uses an addictive substance? Is it that he's homeless that makes you angry about that? Is it that other people give him money and that's what he uses the money for? Because addiction, any kind of addiction, is a monstrous thing. And I think in this country, we have to stop treating addiction as a criminal issue and start treating it as a medical one.
Yeah,
so I really don't mind that a person's homeless and using the money I give them for drugs, because I wouldn't want somebody coming into my home and telling me I can't take the prescribed medication I take every week.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
So this is why we should be thankful for what we've got.
Absolutely.
Because, again, you can lose everything in a heartbeat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You were saying you had a story as well.
Yeah, so I'd finished work one day, went to a local supermarket. There was a homeless man outside. He's always outside this same supermarket all the time. And I said to him the one day, I said, do you want anything picked up? I said, do you want a bottle of water or something to eat? And he came out with, you wouldn't expect it, he came out, can you get me a banana milkshake? And I thought, yeah, okay. So I went in there and I done some shopping, come out with two banana milkshakes, gave them to this guy. You know, I said, look after yourself and I'll be in again and I'll get you another one next time I come in. A few days later, I'd passed the same supermarket, but this homeless guy was now outside of a newsagent's, and he was drinking beer and just, you know, laughing away. He was with about four or five people, and I thought to myself, he's homeless, but he's drinking beer. That was my opinion back then. But, you know, I mean, I think we can appreciate that things are addictive, like you've just said, and you can't control what other people do. You can advise them.
And my thing is, what is that person like as a person?
Again, unless you take the time to do that, you won't know somebody. They could be just like you or me. They've reached hard times and they've just said, you know what, F it, enough's enough.
And I tell you what, and I can see how some people end up in that situation, by the way, based on the research we're doing for this podcast. I can understand how people get to the end of a rope and just throw it all in.
Well, I remember a few months ago, again, another brief story, guys, but me and you was in your car, and we stopped at a local news agent. I don't know whether I can say the name of the news agent or
I
not,
wouldn't.
But I'm not going to, you know, all the laws and stuff.
Not that we're monetized, sorry.
No. But there was a homeless girl outside, and she was, because I remember you had to go to the cash point, and she was, you know, lying on the floor with a big coat on. And do you remember what you said to me that day?
I don't, go on. It was a while ago, I know, but...
You looked at her and you went, that's a shame. And I think, I can't remember, I think you did. I think you went in and you were buying a bottle of water.
Yeah.
And I think I think she was asleep. Mm-hmm. And as you came out, you dropped her something on the floor next to her. So when she woke up, she had a drink. Yeah. And I thought, you know what? It doesn't take 2 minutes to do that for somebody. Especially, you know, if you're a bit flush and you've got an extra £2 in your pocket. Now, to me, I call that flush. You know, just buy someone, help someone in need. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, and we should, our objective in life should be to be just a little bit kinder.
Yeah.
Just a little. If every day we wake up and say,
I feel like doing a Rocky quote. If you can change and I can change, we can all change.
Nice. Yeah. Pull back like it.
Yeah, it's not bad, that one, is it? So let's get back to it.
Okay, well, within the testing process for occupation orders, the court has the power to issue ancillary notices, which can compel a respondent to pay rent, mortgage, maintenance and repair on a property. Now, again, if a domestically abusive individual has funds, go for it. They absolutely should be made to pay. But these notices are great for that purpose, in that they can hurt that person where it hurts, in their wallet.
Yeah, but if these orders have been requested spuriously, that is problematic for the same reason we highlighted last week. The process of obtaining an occupational order often involves adversarial legal proceedings, and I guarantee these will increase tensions with the family unit. This is the biggest issue for me in the whole process. I understand our legal system is adversarial, but what really bothers me is that if occupational orders are paired with non-molestation orders, any chance of mediation, even at a distance, is just taken off the table. Again, it should go without saying, if a person has been abusive, this should be taken away. But if not, Matt?
Yeah, I like the pregnant pause there. You're right. If not, there absolutely shouldn't be the need to remove that component, that important component of the process. We've spoken at length here about the need to have mediation as an alternative to the legal process, if you can. And that's certainly something that we both would advise. So the adversarial nature of the proceedings often exacerbate the stress of the situation. As family court proceedings go, they are also somewhat more complex than other civil matters, because both orders carry a statutory right of arrest. Now, this means court representation often requires a barrister rather than just a solicitor. But McKenzie Friends can be used in these circumstances also.
And occupational orders can also contribute to the stigmatisation and social isolation of individuals, particularly those who are subject to the order. Being legally required to leave the family home and relocate to alternative accommodation can cause social shame, isolation and utter embarrassment.
Yeah, if an occupation order has been taken against you, you can face judgment and scrutiny from neighbours, peers and community members. Worse still, you can face that scrutiny from your own family, and I could imagine nothing quite as painful as that. This can exacerbate the individual's feelings of isolation and marginalisation, that is. and this can have detrimental effects on their mental health, on their well-being, and on the trauma they've experienced by being uprooted and removed from the home that essentially they work so hard for.
It's amazing what having a piece of paper handed to you can make you feel.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And again, I think we should probably make the distinction here that these orders are incredibly good things. They're powerful tools that aid people who are genuinely in need. We're not opposed to occupation orders or non-molestation orders. I think both of us think that they could be improved. The process could be improved.
100%, yeah.
And I know we've banged on about this for a couple of weeks now, but...
I think the hang-up... Sorry to interrupt you, Matt, but the hang-up for me is the 25% that are made fraudulently, should I say. Yeah. That's, you know, I mean, 25%, we all know it's one quarter, or at least I hope we do. I hope everybody does know that. It's a staggering amount.
It's a terrifying number. I was trying to think of a way of having some sort of metaphor or analogy that would help to explain that. And I can't really think one that's directly analogous. But if you looked at it like this, if you imagined that you have a car, you're driving your car, and let's say... every time you're pulled over for breaking the law in that car, you're banned from driving your car for a year. So if you're speeding and you're stopped, you're banned from driving the car for a year. Neither of us would be opposed, and no one out there should be opposed to the 75 out of 100 people who were legitimately stopped and then have the license taken off them. But if that happens to 25% of people, they're stopped and they weren't speeding, and they then lose their license, that's utterly horrific. It's just... the most ludicrous thing ever.
And then you think, why me? why did I get pulled?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the key issue, right? Part of the thing we've said on numerous occasions up until this point is the secrecy of family courts in the UK is problematic. Now, we're not saying we want press in there reporting on the names and the minutiae of details that happen in a family court, but I guarantee that number will reduce significantly when those courts are more transparent.
Yeah, and I think the power of arrest can be attached to occupational orders, obviously depending on whether you break this order. But that would be a civil matter, wouldn't it, Matt?
It can be both. It can be both civil or... there can be a criminal component attached to it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it very much depends on the...
the nature of the order,
it's what the order says specifically. It can be either of those things. I'm pretty sure I've read that.
So occupational orders are often issued along with non-molestation orders and become active at the point you are issued the order. This is delivered to you by a process server, which is the court bailiff, as we've spoke about before. And as we said last week, leave that dude, dudette, or non-binary other alone, whichever you prefer.
Absolutely. It would be so easy, with an order in your hands banning you from entering your home, to lose your ship. We would discourage this. So reach out to your family, your friends, and others to seek emergency accommodation. Don't, for goodness sake, blow up at a process server. They're there to do a job, and they have no obligation to you whatsoever. They weren't in a relationship with you. They've got absolutely no good reason for you losing your ship on them. So from the point you are handed the order, it is active, and as with non-molestation orders, you will need to attend court to contest the order.
Yeah, and I think I want to go back to obviously these orders again. Now we've spoken in depth about non-molestation and occupational orders. Now let's go back to the whole, obviously, legal representation, legal aid. Automatically, on a non-mol and occupational order, you will be automatically granted legal aid. Which, again, I don't mean to keep banging the same drum, but that is so problematic if it's not a genuine case.
Yeah.
It's brilliant for the case of the 75%.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing tool to have at your disposal.
Agreed. I think it's... as we've said previously, though, I'm not sure what the solution to that as an issue is.
Yeah.
But
I think personally, for anybody who does need to seek an occupational order, again, it's the same form as a non-molestation order. There is no court fee when you apply for this. And in some cases, you can get an emergency order which can come through in as little as 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know, because no one should have to live in fear in their own home.
No, no, not at all. I agree.
Which I think we can both safely agree, which you've just said. So that brings us to the end of this week's pod. That was another heavy one, don't you think?
It was indeed.
Should we tell the audience about the future episodes we've got coming up?
Yeah, go for it.
So we've made contact with a range of organisations to be guests on the pod, and I've asked them to join the conversation. Moving forward, we are planning to speak with these individuals to illuminate the complexity of marital breakdown and find ways to navigate through these choppy waters.
So, Lee, hit us with your thought for the day.
So my thought for the day today is you don't have to be better than everybody else. You have to be better than what you think you can be.
Nice one, I like that.
Yeah, it's quite cool, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's you against the world, I like to say.
Hmm.
And I suppose, come on, let's have the amazing dad joke as we have every single week. Please make this one a good one. Any more of these appalling jokes would just end the whole join the conversation now.
Well, I'm telling you, they're going to get worse before they get better. I promise you that. Okay, so let's get into this. So on our street, it's really problematic in terms of finding parking spaces. So just this evening, I went outside and I saw my neighbour having a near mental breakdown because he couldn't find a parking space. This is almost a true story. There really is one of my neighbours who loses his shit every night because he can't park. So I watched as he was struggling to find this parking space, and in sheer frustration, he threw himself to his knees and looked up to the heavens. He clutched his hands together and he exclaimed, "Lord God Allah Buddha," he's rather confused about his religion, you see. "I know I have not been a good servant to you these last few years, but if you open a parking space, I will go to church, mosque, temple, whatever you want. Oh, and I'll give up the drink." Now, at that moment, the heavens opened and the man saw a heavenly light illuminate a parking space that wasn't there before. This caused my neighbour to jump to his feet and shout aloud, "Never mind, I found one."
And there you have it, guys. And I personally think that's probably the best one yet, Matt.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't as bad as they've been previously.
Well, so far, I mean, I'm trying to remember a few of them now. I mean, this wasn't a dad joke, but we've talked about dragons in sheds.
Yep.
Which was quite funny. I thought you were going to talk about that earlier when you mentioned aliens doing your probabilities and possibilities.
Oh, that would have been a good one. Could have done like a Paul situation where Paul the alien lives.
But I'm not redoing all this podcast, Matt, to talk about dragons.
We're not, no.
I think we've discussed everything we need to talk about. But yeah, keep up the good dad jokes.
I will keep up the longer form jokes because they seem to be better than the shorter ones.
And I think this is why people keep coming back for your dad jokes.
Oh, I hope not.
It's not for the information we're giving.
I really hope not. No work goes into the dad jokes. Plenty of work goes into the rest of it. So keep coming back for the important information, folks.
And the dad jokes.
So as always, we're going to end in the usual way. Please read along with Lee if you know the words. The dad creed.
In those moments when you feel downcast, when the hope is sucked from your lungs and your gaze is cast to the floor in despair, raise your head up high, and with the thought of the most precious thing in your life, your children, held firmly in your heart, say the DAD creed with me. I believe in nothing more than the love I have for you, not hell nor high water, not rain nor shine, not hate nor despair, or those who would keep us apart with no true cause to do so, will change this love. A father's love is like no other, imparted on his soul from the moment he first saw the apple of his eye. The rights of fathers and those of their children are not a privilege, they are a right. A right we will exercise with compassion, care, love, and observance of the golden rule. Raise your hands confidently, caringly, and with hope. Be counted, because not all dads are deadbeats.
And so, if you're interested in having riveting conversations about fathers, their children, rights and agency, look out for DAD on the interwebs and social media. We look forward to seeing you and welcoming you to our conversations.